Will Wright has been the foundational genius behind a 30-year string of blockbuster games. From the early Raid on Bungling Bay in 1984 to the first truly fun urban simulation, SimCity. From there, he delved deep into the lives of the individual inhabitants of those cities with The Sims, a game that lets players actually shape how his simulated people interacted with one another, while making them increasingly lifelike and sophisticated in their own actions. In 2008, he released Spore, where the simulations focus on the very evolution of life in the galaxy in a massively parallel game system. Scheduled for 2009, Wright will release the much-awaited Sims 3, in which, for the first time, the Sims can explore the broader world. Wright will be speaking on Sims and gamers in general at the O'Reilly Web 2.0 Expo in San Francisco. O'Reilly editor Kurt Cagle caught up with Will Wright to ask a few questions. You've been doing this a long time. I can remember distinctly playing Raid on Bungling Bay back on the old Commodore's days back in the late 80s. The thing I find fascinating is in every game that you've done in the last 25 years or so, it would more accurately be considered a simulation rather than a game. What have you found so most fascinating about simulations as games?
Well, as a kid, I spent a lot of time building models, actually. Just an inordinate amount of time building little plastic and wooden models. And then that kind of got me into robotics, which is kind of a different form of modeling. And I bought my first computer, which was an Apple II, to connect my robots to control them. And this is when I taught myself to program. And it wasn't too long before I started doing little simulations of the robots I was working on the computer, and I started realizing this was kind of a new way to make models, you know, that I'd kind of grown up making, except these models had dynamics underneath them rather than just static structure.
Right.
And so I guess I've always been fascinated with modeling even before I got a computer. And for me, models are a way of coming to understand the world. I mean, I found that as I built models, it would be around subjects that interested me. And in building a model, you know, it would eliminate certain aspects of, you know, the structure of something to me in a really deep way. And on the computer, as I started building these, you know, very simple little programs, I started realizing this is like the perfect place to build, you know, it's basically the ultimate modeling tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I've always been attracted to models, simulations, and robots. You know, even robots in some sense are a model of human abilities, you know, whether they be physical or mental abilities that we have as humans. When you attempt to build a model of them, you start to realize, you know, how incredibly, you know, elaborate our abilities are and how hard they are to recreate. And it kind of makes you appreciate them in a fundamentally different way.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing when you try and simulate some aspect of the real world, whether it's, you know, a biological system or an economic system. As you start building models of them, you start seeing kind of the unexpected levels of emergence, complexity, kind of the subtle interplay of elements, etc.
Perhaps one of the greatest models that you've done, and you've done some spectacular ones, it has to be SimCity. It's gained a wide following not only among gamers, but among city planners, and I have a feeling there are probably a few economists that also have spent a little more time than they probably care to admit playing around with it. It's easily one of my favorite games. What went into the creation of that? What started the process, and how did you go about modeling something as complex as a city?
Well, actually, it kind of came out of Raid on Bungling Bay, which was, you know, a stupid shoot 'em up where you bomb these little islands. And I had to create an editor where I could scroll around and create these little worlds to bomb. And I found in playing with the editor that I was having a lot more fun creating these worlds than I was blowing them up.
Mm-hmm.
And after I finished that game, I started kind of playing with the editor, and I started decided to add a little bit more dynamics to it. I wanted to see traffic moving on the roads, and I wanted to see kind of dynamic systems operating. So I started reading about city planning. And at first I didn't find the subject that interesting, but as I started developing very simple little simulations of the theories I was reading, it became fascinating to me. And I realized it was fascinating because I had a little guinea pig city that I could sit there and experiment and play with. And that totally changed kind of the nature of my relationship to the subject. And then I got very interested in, you know, the early work in simulation, and all the work of Jay Forrester with System Dynamics, who, interestingly enough, was also one of the first people to actually try to build a digital model of a city. And he wrote a book called Urban Dynamics, although his model was not spatially located. It wasn't on a map. It was just a very simple kind of system dynamics model with, you know, population totals and things like that. But, you know, cities as a subject, I found fascinating just because of all the different layers of, you know, infrastructure and statistics. You know, you have, you know, crime statistics, you have population, pollution, traffic. All these things are overlaid and interrelate to each other. And they interrelate in really interesting ways across different timescales. And when you have a toy city and you can kind of run it through many decades, you start seeing the city as a very organic process. You know, when you just drive around the city and look at it, it looks like a very static thing. But when you can put it in fast forward, it starts looking very much like a living creature. And in fact, shares a lot of the same, you know, kind of infrastructures, you know, communication systems, and circulatory systems, waste disposal systems, etc. And so, I just kind of fell into it, you know, in that sense.
You know, the games have become considerably more complex over the years. When you're modeling them, you know, how much of that modeling, how much of that creation is basically independent agents essentially reacting with the rest of the world? How much of it is coming from external data about how cities work, and how do you update that? You know, obviously, things like what's happening right now in the financial markets and stuff like that, does that impact the way that you're putting together these worlds?
Well, there are a lot of different methods of simulation or prediction. You know, one of them is, you know, kind of trend analysis, or, you know, in stock terms, it would be called technical forecasting, where you look at past data and you try to recapture that. Then there's kind of fundamental analysis, where you're trying to fundamentally recreate the behavior system by modeling its components. That's closer to what we do in our simulation work. And, you know, so they're not very data-driven. You know, it's more like we're building underlying algorithms and playing with those algorithms a lot until we get something that looks reasonable, you know. And typically, in, depending on the type of simulation we're doing, we'll build test cases that, you know, we would expect that if I, you know, A, B, and C happen, the simulator should react this way. And we're kind of playing with the underlying algorithms against these test patterns across, you know, a number of different dimensions of behavior. But for the most part, you know, we're basically exploring an emergent system.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's emergent, you know, by its very nature, we can't sit there and engineer it top-down. You know, what we have to do is we have to sit there and kind of play with a wide variety of algorithms and structures, turn them on, observe their behavior. Then when it doesn't quite do what we want, we go back to the drawing board. We refine it a little bit more. But it feels much more like the process of exploration rather than engineering.
Mm-hmm. Have you found with this kind of approach that it's something that you can take to policymakers and say, you know, maybe you need to stop thinking about this?
I think that's kind of the realization that's happening across a number of fields. You know, it's been happening over the last 10 years, that we basically live in a bottom-up world. We might occasionally try to impose top-down structures on that world. You know, the economy is a really good example of that. You know, at the federal or, you know, government level, you can try all these regulations and tax policies and interest rate adjustments. But at the end of the day, you have millions of independent agents out there, you know, basically making the decisions based upon their confidence in the future and, you know, a number of other factors that are basically, you know, the tide. You know, that's, you know, the primary maybe the system is coming from the bottom up. And what we thought were these high-level controls and reins on the system are getting looser and looser. In fact, they never were that tight. You know?
Yeah.
Typically, you know, we would have, you know, a boom, you know, economy, and they'd go back and say, well, the Fed did a great job, but it really had nothing to do with the Fed. You know, it had to do with underlying cycles that were happening from the bottom up. But I think that this is, you know, it's kind of interesting in that, and it depends on how deep you want to go down this. I mean, you can go all the way back to Aristotle, who was trying to turn, you know, science into a reductionist method. the idea that you could understand a system by taking it apart and understanding its components, you know, works in certain areas, but when you get to a sufficient level of complexity and you have emergence occurring, you really can't look at the individual agents and predict, you know, what their overall group behavior is going to be. And so this is a fundamental limitation, you know, that we're finding across all fields, and I think a fundamental realization that policymakers are even seeing, and modelers and forecasters, et cetera. But I think the world is also getting more emergent and obviously more interconnected, you know, in economic sense, in an environmental sense, you know, and in a, you know, kind of personal social sense. You know, all these kind of things are forming more dense inner web connections between these systems, which makes the emergent kind of factor even higher than it was before.
Mm-hmm. Changing subjects a little bit, my 9-year-old daughter has become a hardcore Sims fan. I can barely keep her off the computer. It's kind of like, Daddy, you're home. Can I play on the computer now? I want to play Sims. I think she sees it as this is the ultimate dollhouse. Obviously, there's been a lot of thinking about psychology and human interaction with this. What challenges did you face when you were putting together The Sims, and what were you trying to do with it, and what did you learn from it?
Well, one of the first kind of challenges was, could we develop a really robust model of human behavior such that we could put these little characters into almost any situation and they would behave reasonably? You know, since the user is kind of controlling the environment, they can put the Sims in a wide variety of potential environments, and then the Sims, you know, have to act reasonable. So we kind of had to develop on the surface, it looks like an object-oriented programming model, but in fact, it's what's technically called a subject-oriented programming model.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't get into that detail. So developing this robust kind of behavior system with Sims, in fact, it was environmentally distributed intelligence is the way we solved it. But, you know, on the design side, you know, there was a lot of thought about how much autonomy do these characters have versus how much reliance do they have on the player directing their actions. And there was also a whole dimension of thought around how much are we going to let the player read into the simulation. You know, in other words, how much of the simulation are we going to offload on the player's imagination versus make, you know, very clear and overt. For instance, when you hear the Sims talk, they speak in this kind of gibberish language. We've actually recorded hundreds of lines of dialogue with a lot of different emotional nuances, but you never actually hear the words. We found that they seemed a lot more real when the players were hearing it as a foreign language, and they were kind of able to read emotional content into this. Oh, they're arguing, or that one's happy. And rather than hearing the actual words, which would start sounding very repetitive and very robotic right off the bat. And so the players in their head kind of fluidly will imagine the conversation. And, you know, it's actually amazing how far we were able to take that in different dimensions.
Uh-huh.
On the original Sims, which is kind of isometric, the characters were only so big on screen, and you could just kind of make out their faces. And it was interesting how many players, after having played for a long time, you know, if I asked them, oh, do the characters have facial expressions, they would all say yes. In fact, they didn't. They all had a very neutral expression. I mean, it was just small enough to where people were imagining their facial expressions, you know, depending on their emotional state. So we were able, you know, very carefully to kind of roll in, you know, how much of the imagination we were leaving blanks for the player to fill in. And there's also a whole question of the resolution, you know, of things like when they're creating a house and moving furniture around, are they working down to the last inch or the nearest meter? And there was a real balance there between ease of use and expressiveness, you know, all the way up to what are the parameters for a Sim's psychology, how many sliders do they have to kind of tweak to program a Sim's character.
What impact do you think Sims 3 will have?
It's hard to say. You know, the Sims, I think, for a lot of players that are really into it, it's more of a hobby than it is a game.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit there, and it's, you know, it's kind of a creative endeavor. Some of the players go off in different directions. Some are very much into the architecture. They design really cool houses and share them with other people. Other ones like run characters or putting their friends and family in and kind of replaying their life in a weird, you know, surreal dimension. And a lot of players will kind of play it for, you know, several weeks, then put it aside. They'll buy an expansion pack, pull it off the shelf, play it again for a few more weeks, put it aside. But they'll actually kind of end up playing it ongoingly over several years. And I think The Sims 3, you know, is kind of reflecting this universe that is familiar to players that have bought The Sims 1 and maybe The Sims 2 and maybe a few expansion packs. And The Sims 3, every time, you know, every generation of The Sims, we're kind of trying to bring the walls further out so they have more possible experiences in the game. Because really, a game like The Sims is all about the player-driven story. The player is the storyteller. Hmm. You know, we're giving them a system where they can put anybody into what they want. They can set up all these different situations and play out their own soap opera or drama or whatever. And, you know, we find by observing what the players do with it, certain areas where they're trying to pick their stories, but they hit a brick wall, or the simulation doesn't support this, you know, in whatever dimension, maybe the behavior of the sim, or something about their environment. And so The Sims 3 is trying to make that storytelling, I think, more seamless, because we found that players in The Sims 2 were spending a lot more time having their sims roam across the entire environment, you know, going to visit their neighbors, going downtown, doing this, getting a job, going to school. And so The Sims 3 makes that environment much more seamless, really, and a smoother storytelling experience.
The other game that you released last year, Spore, I find it interesting because you're now modeling evolutionary processes as well as societal ones, sometimes, you know, in a very funny manner. I've thoroughly enjoyed seeing what I've seen with coming out of Spore. How has Spore been received? What were you hoping to achieve with it besides selling, you know, lots and lots of copies?
Well, it's a game that I'd say still very much in development. You know, a game like Spore was kind of leveraging off of what we saw happening with The Sims and user-generated content, except going to the next level with it, to where much more of a game, where much higher-level tools for customizing content within the game as part of the gameplay. So I always thought that, you know, when we released Spore, the game, that that was about halfway through development. You know, the next step was to see what the fans do with it. And this is kind of what happened with The Sims. We did the first version of The Sims, we watched what the fans did, and then we started doing the expansion packs relative to what we saw the players wanting. And we're starting to develop other experiences and expansions for Spore right now based upon what we've seen the players do. The amount of content that they've created totally blew us away. It was much more than we expected. I was hoping to see maybe around 1 million, you know, player-generated assets by the end of this last year. Instead, we were, you know, we're passing, I haven't even looked at them all, but last time I looked, we were past 70 million.
Wow.
You know, we have 30 million unique creatures in our database, and there are only 7 million unique species on Earth. So, you know, we've outpopulated Earth in a matter of a few months. And what's really amazing is the quality of the assets. I mean, some of these are far better than any of our internal artists were able to make, even when they played with the tools for several years. So it shows you kind of the value of having parallel exploration of a solution space.
Uh-huh.
So in some sense, the game is not just about biology, but the very mechanism through which we're kind of generating these worlds for players is very much like a biological process where you have millions of people, you know, exploring this space, the solution space in parallel. Now we're looking at ways to, you know, make better use of all the huge data in the world the players are creating and give them new experiences with that data. So I'd say Spore is still very much a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. The educational aspects of everything you do, from SimCity all the way through Spore and Sims 3, seems, you know, fairly evident to me. What are your thoughts about the way that we educate kids, and ourselves for that matter, and what do you see, you know, this ongoing process that you're doing, how do you see that possibly changing that?
Well, I think it's, I mean, especially in today's world, you know, it's changing so fast, and we, in fact, you know, have amazing educational technologies available to most kids, at least in this country, that it's much more important to focus on motivating and inspiring the kids than it is on educating them. I think if you can get a kid interested in a subject, they have plenty of easy opportunities to go out there and learn about it. The really hard part is getting them interested in it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, you know, as a kid, there were certain subjects that captured my imagination. and this was before the internet, and I was, you know, able to very easily go out and kind of find out, you know, whatever subject I was very interested in, mostly in bookstores or libraries. Nowadays, every kid has, you know, the internet on their desktop, and whatever they're interested in, they have, you know, incredible resources at their fingertips, you know, if they're just ready to pull them. And I think we're finding that, you know, having kids pull information rather than us pushing them, you know, our model of now for education has been have the kids sit in the classroom and have the teacher sit up and talk to them for an hour, whether or not the kid is really interested in that or not. So I think in terms of what I do and, you know, the way I see technology, you know, relating to education, is I'm much more interested in trying to take subjects that, you know, might seem boring on the surface and turn them into toys, you know, turn them into a fun experience so a kid goes up and we're not even really trying to kind of preach to the kid, but somewhere inside that toy, they start kind of getting, you know, some sense of, even if the toy version of a city or a planet, they start understanding, you know, subjects like, you know, economics or geology or biology in a kind of a fun, engaging way. And also in a way where they're an active participant. You know, they're not just sitting back and listening and having information wash over them, but they're invited in, you know, in a kind of very creative, involved sense.
Mm-hmm. If you're a programmer thinking about getting into the simulation or games market, what skills should you have? What do you look for? What do you look for as in a programmer or a designer?
Well, I think one of the really important skills that we're seeing in both programmers and designers is the ability to do rapid prototyping. And, you know, also we're finding that people with mixed skill sets are far more valuable. So a designer that can do a little bit of programming or a programmer that has a good design sense are both a lot more valuable than a pure designer or pure programmer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a designer at some level, you know, if you understand the way algorithms work and programming works, it doesn't mean you have to be the one programming the game, but that's the material you're working with. It's kind of like a carpenter understanding wood grain. If you're, you know, design is going against the grain of the machine the whole time, it's never going to feel, you know, fit and polished as it could. Likewise, a programmer that has no sense of design, you know, there are always a million ways to solve a programming problem. And if the solution is going kind of along the same path as the design goal, it's going to just work better, you know, in a number of different ways. You know, it really uses kind of craftsmanship of interactive design.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's probably the top of my list.
Interesting. Final question. What's next? Are we going to see Sim String Theory anytime soon?
Oh, I'm starting to dive into new projects right now, but I'm just not ready to talk about them because they take me so long to work on. And so I'm kind of in my immersive research phase right now on the next one.
Well, I want to thank you very much. This has been just absolutely, you know, engaging and intriguing. I look forward to what else is coming out of your brain. It should be very, very fascinating. All right.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Well, thank you.